that they were, of course, for he had put them the himself, and so the tub gave the name to the plot. But the nurse was acquitted on her trial, and it came to nothing. Lord Ashley, of the Cabal, was now Lord Shaftesbury, and was strong against the succession of the Duke of York. The House of Commons, aggravated to the utmost extent, as we may well suppose, by suspicions of the King at EMS conspiracy with the King of France, made a desperate point of the exclusion, still, and were bitter against the Catholics generally. So unjustly bitter were they, I grieve to say, that they impeached the venerable Lord Stafford, a Catholic nobleman 70 years old, of a design to kill the king. The witnesses were that atrocious Oates and two other birds of the same feather. He was found guilty, on evidence quite as foolish as it was false, and was beheaded on Tower Hill. The people were opposed to him when he first appeared upon the scaffold, but, when he had addressed them and shown them how innocent he was and how wickedly he was sent there, their better nature was aroused, and they said, "Ay, we believe you, my lord. God bless you, my lord." The House of Commons refused to let the king have any money until he should consent to the exclusion bill, but, as he could get it and did get it from his master the King of France, he could afford to hold them very cheap. He called a parliament at Oxford, to which he went down with a great show of being armed and protected as if he were in danger of his life, and to which the opposition members also went armed and protected, alleging that they were in fear of the papists, who were numerous among the King of TMS guards. However, they went on with the exclusion bill, and were so earnest upon it that they would have carried it again, if the king had not popped his crown and state robes into a sedan chair, bundled himself into it along with them, hurried down to the chamber where the House of Lords met, and dissolved the Parliament. After which he scampered home, and the members of Parliament scampered home too, as fast as their legs could carry them. The Duke of York, then residing in Scotland, had, under the law which excluded Catholics from public trust, no right whatever to public employment. Nevertheless, he was openly employed as the King at EMS representative in Scotland, and the gratified his sullen and cruel nature to his heart at EMS content by directing the dreadful cruelties against the Covenanters. There were two ministers named Cargill and Cameron who had escaped from the Battle of Bothwell Bridge, and who returned to Scotland, and raised the miserable but still brave and unsubdued Covenanters afresh, under the name of Cameronians. As Cameron publicly posted a declaration that the king was a forsworn tyrant, no mercy was shown to his unhappy followers after he was slain in battle. The Duke of York, who was particularly fond of the boot and derived great pleasure from having it applied, offered their lives to some of these people, if they would cry on the scaffold, "Ay, God save the king." But their relations, friends, and countrymen, had been so barbarously tortured and murdered in this merry reign, that they preferred to die, and did die. The Duke then obtained his merry brother at EMS permission to hold a parliament in Scotland, which first, with most shameless deceit, confirmed the laws for securing the Protestant religion against popery, and then declared that nothing must or should prevent the succession of the Popish Duke. After this double-faced beginning, it established an oath which no human being could understand, but which everybody was to take, as a proof that his religion was the lawful religion. The Earl of Argyll, taking it with the explanation that he did not consider it to prevent him from favouring any alteration either in the church or state which was not inconsistent with the Protestant religion or with his loyalty, was tried for high treason before a Scottish jury of which the Marquis of Montrose was foreman, and was found guilty. He escaped the scaffold, for that time, by getting away, in the disguise of a page, in the train of his daughter, Lady Sophia Lindsay. It was absolutely proposed, by certain members of the Scottish Council, that this lady should be whipped through the streets of Edinburgh, but this was too much even for the Duke, who had the manliness then. He had very little at most times, to remark that Englishmen were not accustomed to treat ladies in that manner. In those merry times nothing could equal the brutal servility of the Scottish fawners, but the conduct of similar degraded beings in England. After the settlement of these little affairs, the Duke returned to England, and soon resumed his place at the council, and his office of High Admiral are all this by his brother at EMS favor, and in open defiance of the law. It would have been no loss to the country, if he had been drowned when his ship, in going to Scotland to fetch his family, struck on a sandbank, and was lost with 200 souls on board. But he escaped in a boat with some friends, and the sailors were so brave and unselfish, that, when they saw him rowing away, they gave 3 cheers, while they themselves were going down for ever. The Merry Monarch, having got rid of his parliament, went to work to make himself despotic, with all speed. Having had the villainy to order the execution of Oliver Plunkett, Bishop of Armagh, falsely accused of a plot to establish popery in that country by means of a French army, the very thing this royal traitor was himself trying to do at home, and having tried to ruin Lord Shaftesbury, and failed, he turned his hand to controlling the corporations all over the country, because, if he could only do that, he could get what juries he chose, to bring in perjured verdicts, and could get what members he chose returned to Parliament. These merry times produced, and made Chief Justice of the Court of King at EMS Bench, a drunken ruffian of the name of Jeffreys, a red-faced, swollen, bloated, horrible creature, with a bullying, roaring voice, and a more savage nature perhaps than was ever lodged in any human breast. This monster was the Merry Monarch at EMS's special favorite, and he testified his admiration of him by giving him a ring from his own finger, which the people used to call Judge Jeffreys at EMS Bloodstone. Him the king employed to go about and bully the corporations, beginning with London, or, as Jeffreys himself elegantly called it, a to give them a lick with the rough side of his tongue.atm, and he did it so thoroughly, that they soon became the basest and most sycophantic bodies in the kingdom except the University of Oxford, which, in that respect, was quite pre-eminent and unapproachable. Lord Shaftesbury, who died soon after the King of TMS failure against him, Lord William Russell, the Duke of Monmouth, Lord Howard, Lord Jersey, Algernon Sidney, John Hampden, grandson of the great Hampden, and some others, used to hold a council together after the dissolution of the Parliament, arranging what it might be necessary to do, if the King carried his popish plot to the utmost height. Lord Shaftesbury, having been much the most violent of this party, brought 2 violent men into their secret, Sir Rumsey, who had been a soldier in the Republican army, and West, a lawyer. These 2 knew an old officer of Cromwell at EMS, called Rumbold, who had married a maltster, a TMS widow, and so had come into possession of a solitary dwelling called the Rye House, near Hoddesdon, in Hertfordshire. Rumbold said to them what a capital place this house of his would be from which to shoot at the king, who often passed the going to and fro from Newmarket. They liked the idea, and entertained it. But, one of their body gave information, and they, together with Shepherd, a wine merchant, Lord Russell, Algernon Sidney, Lord Essex, Lord Howard, and Hampden, were all arrested. Lord Russell might have easily escaped, but scorned to do so, being innocent of any wrong. Lord Essex might have easily escaped, but scorned to do so, lest his flight should prejudice Lord Russell. But it weighed upon his mind that he had brought into their council Lord Howard, who now turned a miserable traitor against the great dislike Lord Russell had always had of him. He could not bear the reflection, and destroyed himself before Lord Russell was brought to trial at the Old Bailey. He knew very well that he had nothing to hope, having always been manful in the Protestant cause against the 2 false brothers, the one on the throne, and the other standing next to it. He had a wife, one of the noblest and best of women, who acted as his secretary on his trial, who comforted him in his prison, who supped with him on the night before he died, and whose love and virtue and devotion have made her name imperishable. Of course, he was found guilty, and was sentenced to be beheaded in Lincoln at EMS in Fields, not many yards from his own house. When he had parted from his children on the evening before his death, his wife still stayed with him until 10 o'clock at night, and when their final separation in this world was over, and he had kissed her many times, he still sat for a long while in his prison, talking of her goodness. Hearing the rain fall fast at that time, he calmly said, "Aye, such a rain tomorrow will spoil a great show, which is a dull thing on a rainy day. At midnight he went to bed, and slept till 4, even when his servant called him, he fell asleep again while his clothes were being made ready. He rode to the scaffold in his own carriage, attended by two famous clergymen, Tillotson and Burnet, and sang a psalm to himself very softly, as he went along. He was as quiet and as steady as if he had been going out for an ordinary ride. After saying that he was surprised to see so great a crowd, he laid down his head upon the block, as if upon the pillow of his bed, and had it struck off at the second blow. His noble wife was busy for him even then, for that true-hearted lady printed and widely circulated his last words, of which he had given her a copy. They made the blood of all the honest men in England boil. The University of Oxford distinguished itself on the very same day by pretending to believe that the accusation against Lord Russell was true, and by calling the king, in a written paper, the breath of their nostrils and the anointed of the Lord. This paper the Parliament afterwards caused to be burned by the common hangman, which I am sorry for, as I wish it had been framed and glazed and hung up in some public place, as a monument of baseness for the scorn of mankind. Next came the trial of Algernon Sidney, at which Jeffreys presided, like a great crimson toad, sweltering and swelling with rage. "I pray God, Mr. Sidney, A.T.M.," said this Chief Justice of a merry reign, after passing sentence, "to work in you a temper fit to go to the other world, for I see you are not fit for this. A.T.M. my lord, A.T.M.," said the prisoner, composedly holding out his arm, "feel my pulse, and see if I be disordered. I thank heaven I never was in better temper than I am now." A.T.M. Algernon Sidney was executed on Tower Hill, on the 7th of December, 1683. He died a hero, and died, in his own words, for that good old cause in which he had been engaged from his youth, and for which God had so often and so wonderfully declared himself. A.T.M. The Duke of Monmouth had been making his uncle, the Duke of York, very jealous, by going about the country in a royal sort of way, playing at the people TMS games, becoming godfather to their children, and even touching for the king of TMS evil, or stroking the faces of the sick to cure them. Though, for the matter of that, I should say he did them about as much good as any crowned king could have done. His father had got him to write a letter, confessing his having had a part in the conspiracy, for which Lord Russell had been beheaded. But he was ever a weak man, and as soon as he had written it, he was ashamed of it and got it back again. For this, he was banished to the Netherlands, but he soon returned and had an interview with his father, unknown to his uncle. It would seem that he was coming into the merry monarch at TMS favour again, and that the Duke of York was sliding out of it, when death appeared to the merry galleries at Whitehall, and astonished the debauched lords and gentlemen, and the shameless ladies, very considerably. On Monday, the 2nd of February, 1685, the merry pensioner and servant of the King of France fell down in a fit of apoplexy. By the Wednesday his case was hopeless, and on the Thursday he was told so. As he made a difficulty about taking the sacrament from the Protestant Bishop of Bath, the Duke of York got all who were present away from the bed, and asked his brother, in a whisper, if he should send for a Catholic priest. The king replied, for God at TMS sake, brother, do. A.T.M. The Duke smuggled in, up the back stairs, disguised in a wig and gown, a priest named Huddleston, who had saved the king of TMS life after the Battle of Worcester, telling him that this worthy man in the wig had once saved his body, and was now come to save his soul. The merry monarch lived through that night, and died before noon on the next day, which was Friday, the 6th. Two of the last things he said were of a human sort, and your remembrance will give him the full benefit of them. When the queen sent to say she was too unwell to attend him and to ask his pardon, he said, alas, poor woman, she beg my pardon. I beg hers with all my heart. Take back that answer to her. A.T.M. And he also said, in reference to Nell Gwynn, do not let poor Nelly starve. A.T.M. He died in the 55th year of his age, and the 25th of his reign. Chaptixxx view England under James II. King James II was a man so very disagreeable, that even the best of historians has favoured his brother Charles, as becoming, by comparison, quite a pleasant character. The one object of his short reign was to re-establish the Catholic religion in England, and this he doggedly pursued with such a stupid obstinacy, that his career very soon came to a close. The first thing he did, was, to assure his council that he would make it his endeavour to preserve the government, both in church and state, as it was by law established, and that he would always take care to defend and support the church. Great public acclamations were raised over this fair speech, and a great deal was said, from the pulpits and elsewhere, about the word of a king which was never broken, by credulous people who little supposed that he had formed a secret council for Catholic affairs, of which a mischievous Jesuit, called Father Petre, was one of the chief members. With tears of joy in his eyes, he received, as the beginning of his pension from the King of France, 500,000 livres, yet, with a mixture of meanness and arrogance that belonged to his contemptible character, he was always jealous of making some show of being independent of the King of France, while he pocketed his money. As then notwithstanding his publishing two papers in favour of Popery, and not likely to do it much service, I should think, written by the King, his brother, and found in his strong box, and his open display of himself attending Mass of the Parliament was very obsequious, and granted him a large sum of money, he began his reign with a belief that he could do what he pleased, and with a determination to do it. Before we proceed to its principal events, let us dispose of Titus Oates. He was tried for perjury, a fortnight after the coronation, and besides being very heavily fined, was sentenced to stand twice in the pillory, to be whipped from Aldgate to Newgate one day, and from Newgate to Tyburn 2 days afterwards, and to stand in the pillory 5 times a year as long as he lived. This fearful sentence was actually inflicted on the rascal. Being unable to stand after his first flogging, he was dragged on a sledge from Newgate to Tyburn, and flogged as he was drawn along. He was so strong a villain that he did not die under the torture, but lived to be afterwards pardoned and rewarded, though not to be ever believed in any more. Dangerfield, the only other one of that crew left alive, was not so fortunate. He was almost killed by a whipping from Newgate to Tyburn, and, as if that were not punishment enough, a ferocious barrister of Grettier Messin gave him a poke in the eye with his cane, which caused his death, for which the ferocious barrister was deservedly tried and executed. As soon as James was on the throne, Argyll and Monmouth went from Brussels to Rotterdam, and attended a meeting of Scottish exiles held there, to concert measures for a rising in England. It was agreed that Argyll should effect a landing in Scotland, and Monmouth in England, and that 2 Englishmen should be sent with Argyll to be in his confidence, and 2 Scotchmen with the Duke of Monmouth. Argyll was the first to act upon this contract. But, 2 of his men being taken prisoners at the Orkney Islands, the government became aware of his intention, and was able to act against him with such vigour as to prevent his raising more than 2,000 or 3,000 Highlanders, although he sent a fiery cross, by trusty messengers, from clan to clan and from glen to glen, as the custom then was when those wild people were to be excited by their chiefs. As he was moving towards Glasgow with his small force, he was betrayed by some of his followers, taken, and carried, with his hands tied behind his back, to his old prison in Edinburgh Castle. James ordered him to be executed, on his old shamefully unjust sentence, within 3 days, and he appears to have been anxious that his legs should have been pounded with his old favourite the boot. However, the boot was not applied, he was simply beheaded, and his head was set upon the top of Edinburgh Jail. One of those Englishmen who had been assigned to him was that old soldier Rumbold, the master of the Rye House. He was sorely wounded, and within a week after Argyll had suffered with great courage, was brought up for trial, lest he should die and disappoint the king. He, too, was executed, after defending himself with great spirit, and saying that he did not believe that God had made the greater part of mankind to carry saddles on their backs and bridles in their mouths, and to be ridden by a few, booted and spurred for the purpose in which I thoroughly agree with Rumbold. The Duke of Monmouth, partly through being detained and partly through idling his time away, was 5 or 6 weeks behind his friend when he landed at Lyme, in Dorset, having at his right hand an unlucky nobleman called Lord Grey of Werk, who of himself would have ruined a far more promising expedition. He immediately set up his standard in the marketplace, and proclaimed the king a tyrant, and a popish usurper, and I know not what else, charging him, not only with what he had done, which was bad enough, but with what neither he nor anybody else had done, such as setting fire to London, and poisoning the late king. Raising some 4,000 men by these means, he marched on to Taunton, where there were many Protestant dissenters who were strongly opposed to the Catholics. Here, both the rich and poor turned out to receive him. Ladies waved a welcome to him from all the windows as he passed along the streets, flowers were strewn in his way, and every compliment and honour that could be devised was showered upon him. Among the rest, 20 young ladies came forward, in their best clothes, and in their brightest beauty, and gave him a Bible ornamented with their own fair hands, together with other presents. Encouraged by this homage, he proclaimed himself king, and went on to Bridgewater. But, here the government troops, under the Earl of Feversham, were close at hand, and he was so dispirited at finding that he made but few powerful friends after all, that it was a question whether he should disband his army and endeavour to escape. It was resolved, at the instance of that unlucky Lord Grey, to make a night attack on the King O'TM's army, as it lay encamped on the edge of a morass called Sedgemoor. The horsemen were commanded by the same unlucky lord, who was not a brave man. He gave up the battle almost at the first obstacle, which was a deep drain, and although the poor countrymen, who had turned out for Monmouth, fought bravely with scythes, poles, pitchforks, and such poor weapons as they had, they were soon dispersed by the trained soldiers, and fled in all directions. When the Duke of Monmouth himself fled, was not known in the confusion, but the unlucky Lord Grey was taken early next day, and then another of the party was taken, who confessed that he had parted from the Duke only 4 hours before. Strict search being made, he was found disguised as a peasant, hidden in a ditch under fern and nettles, with a few peas in his pocket which he had gathered in the fields to eat. The only other articles he had upon him were a few papers and little books, one of the latter being a strange jumble, in his own writing, of charms, songs, recipes, and prayers. He was completely broken. He wrote a miserable letter to the king, beseeching and entreating to be allowed to see him. When he was taken to London, and conveyed bound into the King O'TM's presence, he crawled to him on his knees, and made a most degrading exhibition. As James never forgave or relented towards anybody, he was not likely to soften towards the issuer of the Lyme proclamation, so he told the suppliant to prepare for death. On the 15th of July, 1685, this unfortunate favourite of the people was brought out to die on Tower Hill. The crowd was immense, and the tops of all the houses were covered with gazers. He had seen his wife, the daughter of the Duke of Buccleuch, in the Tower, and had talked much of a lady whom he loved far better, the Lady Harriet Wentworther, who was one of the last persons he remembered in this life. Before laying down his head upon the block he felt the edge of the axe, and told the executioner that he feared it was not sharp enough, and that the axe was not heavy enough. On the executioner replying that it was of the proper kind, the Duke said, "I pray you have a care, and do not use me so awkwardly as you used my Lord Russell." ATM The executioner, made nervous by this, and trembling, struck once and merely gashed him in the neck. Upon this, the Duke of Monmouth raised his head and looked the man reproachfully in the face. Then he struck twice, and then thrice, and then threw down the axe, and cried out in a voice of horror that he could not finish that work. The sheriffs, however, threatening him with what should be done to himself if he did not, he took it up again and struck a fourth time and a fifth time. Then the wretched head at last fell off, and James, Duke of Monmouth, was dead, in the 36th year of his age. He was a showy, graceful man, with many popular qualities, and had found much favor in the open hearts of the English. The atrocities committed by the government, which followed this Monmouth rebellion, form the blackest and most lamentable page in English history. The poor peasants, having been dispersed with great loss, and their leaders having been taken, one would think that the implacable king might have been satisfied. But no, he let loose upon them, among other intolerable monsters, a Colonel Kirke, who had served against the Moors, and whose soldiers are called by the people Kirkatia Mess Lambs, because they bore a lamb upon their flag, as the emblem of Christianity were worthy of their leader. The atrocities committed by these demons in human shape are far too horrible to be related here. It is enough to say, that besides most ruthlessly murdering and robbing them, and ruining them by making them buy their pardons at the price of all they possessed, it was one of Kirkatiam's favourite amusements, as he and his officers sat drinking after dinner, and toasting the king, to have batches of prisoners hanged outside the windows for the Kirkatiam's diversion, and that when their feet quivered in the convulsions of death, he used to swear that they should have music to their dancing, and would order the drums to beat and the trumpets to play. The detestable king informed him, as an acknowledgement of these services, that he was a very well satisfied with his proceedings. 80m But the king of TM's great delight was in the proceedings of Jeffreys, now a peer, who went down into the West, with four other judges, to try persons accused of having had any share in the rebellion. The king pleasantly called this a Jeffreys a TMS campaign. 80m The people down in that part of the country remember it to this day as the Bloody Assize. It began at Winchester, where a poor deaf old lady, Mrs. Alicia Lyle, the widow of one of the judges of Charles I, who had been murdered abroad by some royalist assassins, was charged with having given shelter in her house to two fugitives from Sedgemoor. Three times the jury refused to find her guilty, until Jeffreys bullied and frightened them into that false verdict. When he had extorted it from them, he said, "A gentleman, if I had been one of you, and she had been my own mother, I would have found her guilty ; as I dare say he would." He sentenced her to be burned alive, that very afternoon. The clergy of the cathedral and some others interfered in her favor, and she was beheaded within a week. As a high mark of his approbation, the king made Jeffreys Lord Chancellor, and he then went on to Dorchester, to Exeter, to Taunton, and to Wells. It is astonishing, when we read of the enormous injustice and barbarity of this beast, to know that no one struck him dead on the judgment seat. It was enough for any man or woman to be accused by an enemy, before Jeffreys, to be found guilty of high treason. One man who pleaded not guilty, he ordered to be taken out of court upon the instant, and hanged, and this so terrified the prisoners in general that they mostly pleaded guilty at once. At Dorchester alone, in the course of a few days, Jeffreys hanged 80 people, besides whipping, transporting, imprisoning, and selling as slaves, great numbers. He executed, in all, 250, or 300. These executions took place, among the neighbors and friends of the sentenced, in 36 towns and villages. Their bodies were mangled, steeped in cauldrons of boiling pitch and tar, and hung up by the roadsides, in the streets, over the very churches. The sight and smell of heads and limbs, the hissing and bubbling of the infernal cauldrons, and the tears and terrors of the people, were dreadful beyond all description. One rustic, who was forced to steep the remains in the black pot, was ever afterwards called a Tom Boyleman. 80m The hangman has ever since been called Jack Ketch, because a man of that name went hanging and hanging, all day long, in the train of Jeffreys. You will hear much of the horrors of the great French Revolution. Many and terrible they were, there is no doubt, but I know of nothing worse, done by the maddened people of France in that awful time, than was done by the highest judge in England, with the express approval of the King of England, in the Bloody Assize. Nor was even this all. Jeffreys was as fond of money for himself as of misery for others, and he sold pardons wholesale to fill his pockets. The king ordered, at one time, 1,000 prisoners to be given to certain of his favorites, in order that they might bargain with them for their pardons. The young ladies of Taunton who had presented the Bible were bestowed upon the maids of honour at court, and those precious ladies made very hard bargains with them indeed.